In the name of God, most gracious, most compassionate. Good evening. Thank you very much for coming here tonight. It's been a while since the last time I was at the center. The title of tonight's presentation indeed is not only eye-catching, but for those of you who are familiar with the current affairs in the Islamic world, it's a very controversial as well. A disclaimer at the very outset, this topic is extremely close and near and dear to my heart. And the disclaimer is that I'm a Muslim reformer myself. I've been deeply involved in this sort of issues for the past 20-25 years. Let me begin with a sort of introduction so that we are all on the same page. For one reason or another, our media tend to give the impression that the 1.2 billion Muslims worldwide are a monolith. In other words, it's as if all the Muslims are quite traditional in their outlook and in their ways, and they are all prone to extremism. This is the kind of impression that most people get by reading the mainstream media. Over the years at the center and elsewhere around the country, I have really tried very hard to counter this inaccurate image and try to showcase the tremendous diversity that exists in Islam. And tonight's presentation serves exactly the same purpose. I believe tonight's presentation is very important to non-Muslim Americans, since our foreign policy has been tangled with Islam and Muslims for the past few decades, and I really believe that for the foreseeable future, still the U.S. foreign policy is going to be entangled with Islam and Muslims. Our policymakers really need to be aware of this tremendous diversity that exists across the Islamic world, especially when they want to strategize and formulate their policies vis-a-vis the Islamic world. If they don't, if they do not appreciate and understand this diversity, they're going to run the risk of alienating the progressive and moderate Muslims, and unwittingly they're going to strengthen the hands of the very extremists that they seek to marginalize. So this presentation is very important for non-Muslim Americans. But for Muslims, I believe it's very important to really have a good grasp of everything that are mentioned here tonight. As I mentioned, Mr. Nima Asami, a few weeks ago sent me a long list of questions that he had, and he wanted me to address those questions at ICCF. Let me share with you two of those questions, which I think are very important, and it's going to be a very good stepping stone for my talk tonight. It is his first question. Is Islam a religion that promotes adaptation to the changing world, or does it limit change in order to emulate the time of the Prophet? Can Islam keep the rapidly changing Western society within its scope? Is the Quran a living document that we can take into the future, or do we stifle progress in the name of keeping our world more familiar with the past? Very insightful question. I mean, this is the kind of question that I have been grappling with myself for at least the past 2-3 decades. He had another question for me. He said, would you bluntly explain the pros and cons of orthodox versus progressive belief in Islam? What is the future for each? Now, as I travel around the United States, other youth have the same sort of questions. Let me give you a few more of those that I, ask quite frequently. Can Islam embrace the Universal Declaration of Human Rights? Can Muslims accept the separation of church and state? Can Muslim nations genuinely adopt multi-party democratic systems and a legal framework that gives equal protection under the law to all the citizens irrespective of their creed? Does Islam advocate separation of sexes in the public sphere? Another question that is very much on the mind of the youth. How about courtship? Can observant Muslim men and women date before they get married while respecting Islamic norms and values? What does authentic Islam teach us about all of these questions? Tonight I'm hoping that I would provide you with a framework to answer all these questions. I'm not going to individually answer these questions, but I'm going to attempt to give you a framework that you can at least begin to address these questions. Let me speak a few minutes about diversity in Islam. Now, I submit to you that if you go around the Islamic world and pose the questions that I just raised here, you will get completely different answers, which basically shows that there is a lot of diversity, theological diversity, amongst Muslims. I'm sure all of you, even non-Muslims, have heard of one of the major divisions in the Islamic world between the Shi'i and the Sunni branches of Islam. And you might add the Sufi branch as well. And within each, you have subgroups as well. We have a great deal of diversity in Islamic jurisprudence. We have at least today 5 or 6 different jurisprudential schools of thought. So when it comes to Islamic law, not all Muslims think alike. Within the religious discourse, even in the Sunni tradition, you have the Tazali versus the Ash'ari, and we have also the Sunni discourse, the Shi'i discourse as well. There is a lot of diversity in the Islamic world. There is another division, though, that is shaping up in the Islamic world, and that division has received little or no traction in the mainstream US media. And that's the focal point of my discussion tonight. This division that I'm going to address tonight is nowhere to be seen on the our media's radar screen at all. For that matter, a lot of Muslims are not even aware of this kind of division. This division is between two groups of Muslims with a radically different theological viewpoints. One group, I would call them the Orthodox traditionalist viewpoint, and the other one is the reformist viewpoints. These two groups, on daily basis, especially in academic circles, they butt her heads. They have drastically different views on a lot of things with respect to Islamic theology. Remember, they are all Muslims. They believe in the same God, the same sacred book, the Quran. They believe in the same Prophet Muhammad. They pretty much practice exactly the same type of prayers every day. However, they have radically different appreciation of all of that. Now you might ask, what is fueling this division? How did this division come about? The answer is very simple. What fuels this debate, this immense debate in the Islamic world between the reformists and the Orthodox, is a phenomenon we are all too familiar with. Modernity. Modernity. How should Muslims react to modern norms, modern values, practices, and institutions? This is the question that both groups are facing, and they are providing radically different answers to these questions. Should Muslims embrace or reject the modern way of life? You see, The Sunni Shi'i divide was political in nature. Right? It wasn't a theological division at the beginning. A lot of people think that at the outset, right after the death of the Prophet Muhammad, Muslims started arguing over theology. That's not really the case. The first division in the Islamic world was political in nature. Who should lead the Islamic community after the death of the Prophet Muhammad? It was only in time that these two groups, one of them who followed Ali and those who did not, over time, they created new appreciation of the Holy Quran. They developed new schools of jurisprudence and discourse. Okay? So it was political in nature, the difference, and then later on it led to different theologies, basically. Today, obviously, there are a lot of theological differences between the Shi'is and the Sunnis. Now, the division between the Orthodox and the Reformers is philosophical in nature. However, it will have dramatic political implications in the future. Right? So that's the difference between the first division in the Islamic history and the way what we're seeing today. Today's division is really rooted in different philosophical perspectives. Traditionalists still predominate the Muslim world. I might add, most of the Islamic centers, most of the mosques, even in California, are pretty much dominated by the Orthodox traditional thinking in Islam. In seminaries and religious schools, pretty much the standard textbooks, the standard teaching is the Orthodox and the traditionalist one. These traditionalists advocate Orthodoxy. They are very conservative in all respects. They believe that we need to preserve the body of knowledge, the practices, the traditions that have been handed to us by previous generations. We should not really try to alter this body of knowledge that we are calling Islam. To them, Islam is what the scholars of the early Islamic period understood and articulated. This is a very critical point. What the early scholars, like 1,000 years ago, 1,200 years ago, their appreciation, their understanding of Islam, the way they articulated the articles of faith, so on and so forth, that is the original Islam, and that's what we need to preserve. Reformers, on the other hand, are the progressive wing of the Islamic community worldwide. They are still a fairly small minority, I have to admit. However, their numbers are definitely growing, and also their socio-political clout is also growing in some parts of the Islamic world, particularly in Iran, Turkey, and Egypt. If I were to single out three countries where these reformers are having a great impact, basically it would be first in Iran. Under the radar, I mean, the reformers are very active in Iran, and periodically you see some kind of a political upheaval in Iran, and typically these reformers, religious reformers, are fueling this kind of dissension in Iranian politics. In Turkey and Egypt as well, reformers are definitely on the rise. Now, Muslim reformers argue that much of the body of knowledge, much of the social traditions handed down to us from previous generations are outdated. Much of that body of knowledge we call Islam today is outdated. One cannot live in the modern world and at the same time truly practice those teachings. There is definitely a lot of tension between the two. So, they advocate reform. For what purpose? The reform is to make Islam relevant and responsive to a fast changing world. That is really the purpose behind the reform, to make Islam relevant again in the modern world. It's probably important to make a note here. The reformist traditionalist division cut across the Sunni Shi'i grouping, by the way. You have Shi'is who are reformers as well as Sunnis. You have Shi'i traditionalists and Sunni traditionalists. What is even more important, Shi'i reformers feel far closer to Sunni reformers than their Shi'i traditionalist counterparts, and vice versa. So the takeaway from the first part of my lecture is this. This theological debate, this theological struggle between the traditionalists and reformers is a direct consequence of modernity's incursion in the Islamic world. These two groupings have drastically different assessment of modernity. Here is another important point that I would like to share with you. They are both Muslims, but they have radically different assessments of modernity. The traditionalists basically have a very dim view of modernity. They believe that modernity, the modern way of life, is inherently anti-religious, particularly because modernity and secularism always go hand in hand. So the conservatives contend that modern society has no respect for religious beliefs and values. It is inconsistent with the religious way of life. It does not basically recognize the authority of religion. Let me repeat one more time. According to them, modernity does not respect the authority of religion. And what they mean by that, the authority of religion, they mean authority of the clerical establishment. As you will find out later, usually in most societies, especially Islamic societies, those who speak for religion are the clerical establishment. Let me also make a very quick point here so that we are on the same page. Modernity is very different than consuming modern products and technologies. If consumption of modern technologies and services would be the hallmark of modernity, Saudi Arabia would be the most modern society on earth. But as we all know, that Saudi Arabia, by and large, is still a tribal pre-modern society. So that's number one. Modernity, more than anything else, is a way of thinking about the world. So anyhow, this is basically the conservative viewpoint. Reformers, on the other hand, argue that modernity is no more or less compatible with religion than any other prior social formation. In other words, the distance, let's say, between Islam and modernity is exactly the same as the distance between Islam and tribalism and feudalism. That's their argument. According to the reformers, if we truly understand what faith is, you should be able to practice faith equally in a tribal society, an industrial society, an agrarian society, a post-industrial or information-based society. Here again, we are talking about faith, not talking about social traditions. I'm talking about faith itself. So that's one of the hallmarks of their thinking and their assessment of modernity. What's more, and here is another important point they make, modernity is not a passing cloud. You see, the traditionalists in the Islamic world are of the opinion that modernity will ultimately fail. It's going to wither away. Reformers disagree with that. They said modernity, for better or worse, is here to stay. So we better deal with it. We should do exactly what our forerunners did in earlier historical periods. When, for example, societies went from tribalism to agrarian and then to, let's say, industrial age, what did religious folks do? Initially, they grumbled. Invariably, that's what happens. On the threshold of a new historical era, you will always have, the core of the religious community up in arms. They would say this new social formation negates everything we believe in. But later on, they start rethinking their, belief system, and they adapt. Invariably, every religious community adapts to socio-historical and political changes. Christians have done it, Muslims have done it, not just today. I'm talking about across history. So reformers argue that now we are at it again. We are on the threshold of a new era in the Islamic world. We better adapt to the changing world. Now, in the remainder of my talk tonight, I will present to you an overview of the main issues in the Orthodox reformist debate. I'm going to give you a narrative. I know that it is very difficult to be impartial for anybody, and I'm not impartial either. But I will do the best I can to present to you the views of the two groups as they articulated with respect to the topic of the presentation tonight. So the traditionalist Orthodox perspective. I'm going to spend more time, by the way, on the reformist perspective for an obvious reason. This is what is less known around the world. Most of us are more familiar with the traditionalist view, perspective, because it is the predominant one in the Islamic world. It is the reformist ideas and arguments that we haven't heard much, and that's what I'm going to focus for the most part in my lecture. But a narrative of the traditionalist and the Orthodox perspective. Number one, these folks are literalist. What does literalism mean? Literalism basically means that, for example, when the Quran says that God created the heavens and the earth in 6 days, God created the heavens and the earth in 6 days, 6 times 24 hours. That's what it means. So whenever one takes something literally, there is no room for flexibility. That's the hallmark of literalism. There is only and only one meaning for every verse in a sacred book, be it the Jewish sacred book, the Muslim or the Christian sacred book. There is only one meaning for every text. It's pretty much black and white. There is one correct meaning and many incorrect meanings. Why? Because the truth is one. Now, many of you might shake your head and say, yeah, the truth is one. But you know what? This is a philosophical position. It doesn't have to be this way. It's really rooted in ancient Greek philosophy. It was the Greek philosophers who argued that the truth is one. It's either black or white. Modernity completely did away with this perspective. Those of you who are familiar with modern philosophy, Kant forward, you know what I'm talking about. So, the hallmark of the Orthodox or the traditionalist camp is the fact that they tend to have a literalist perspective on religion. The second one, Islam is perfect. That's what they contend. Islam is perfect. Well, every Muslim, I submit to you, believes that Islam is perfect. So what is the significance of that? What is the significance of the Orthodox contention that Islam is perfect? To them, perfect means comprehensive. For those of you who are taking notes, you may want to write it down. When the Orthodox talk about Islam being perfect, What they mean is Islam is very comprehensive. Islam contains a complete set of instructions for daily living, both at the individual level as well as the public level. The comprehensive way of life. It describes in detail the rules and regulations for the individual as well as public sphere. Sharia, or God's revealed law, informs Muslims how they should lead their personal as well as their public lives. Now, some elements of Sharia obviously come from the verses in the Holy Quran, but the majority of Sharia actually does not come from the Holy Quran. They either come from the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad, or in the Shi'i tradition it comes from the Imams or the saints. The critical theological point is this, and this is a very critical one. To these folks, the oral tradition is on a par with the Holy Quran. I mean, if you go to, I would say, the average mosque in this country, when they talk about oral tradition, they give it exactly the same weight, the same credence as they would do to a verse in the Holy Quran. In other words, all of Sharia, be it verses from the Quran or the oral tradition, are binding on Muslims. They are not optional. They are binding on Muslims. They are not considered opinions of man, but rather somehow they are revealed. So whenever they talk about Sharia, it's not something that, you can pick and choose. When they say it is Islamic law, it means it is binding on Muslims to follow that. Now, the third hallmark of the traditionalism, the religious instructions, rules and regulations are pretty much eternal. What does it mean? What does it mean that Sharia is eternal? It means that Muslims should observe them forever. Muslims should observe these rules and regulations forever. Number four, the eternal nature of Sharia has a very important implications. And here's what probably Mr. Nima Asami was alluding to before, because I'm sure he's heard the same concept in a lot of mosques. Muslims must maintain and organize their societies in such a way that Sharia would always apply. Let me repeat one more time. If you talk to the Taliban in Afghanistan or the mullahs in Iran, that's exactly what they're going to tell you. That we need to maintain our societies in such a way that the Sharia that has been handed down to us would still be applicable. That is one of the hallmarks of their thinking, and that's the basis for their conservatism. Because as soon as you start making changes to society and the social structure, what was developed in the past may not really be applicable anymore. So you are at the crossroads. What do? Either you should negate the social change, or you should negate the regulations that have been handed down to you. The next point. Implicitly, they believe that the learned and the scholars of the early Islamic period had a better perspective on true Islam. That they had a better perspective on true Islam. Why? Because either they were wiser or purer, or because they were closer in time to the Prophet Muhammad era, or maybe because their social setting was less corrupted than the social settings we have in the modern era. So they had a better perspective on true Islam. You see, after the Prophet Muhammad, Islamic law, discourse and theology started growing very rapidly. Ultimately, it reached a peak, right? For these folks, at its peak, whatever the theology was, that's as good as it's going to get. So future generations of Muslims should probably submit to this rigid structure that have basically emerged in the past. So Muslim generations in the future should be pretty much consumers of this knowledge, not contributors, not enhancers of this body of knowledge. So in this sense, Islam is fixed. It's not flexible, it's not open to new interpretations, it is pretty much fixed. Let me mention one more point with respect to orthodoxy, and I'm going to move on to the reformist viewpoint. What do the traditional Orthodox Muslim think of reformers and reformation? Well, to them, reform means that something is broken or imperfect. Right? So if everything is just perfect the way it is, what do you want to reform? So as soon as you talk about reform, the assumption is that what you're trying to reform is broken or it is not perfect. But to them, Islam is perfect. So according to them, reformers are misguided. They have simply caved in to the demands of anti-Islam forces in the modern era. They are corrupted by un-Islamic influences coming from the West. The secular Western culture with its new philosophies and new sciences have corrupted this new generation of reformists. According to them, Islam does not need a reform. If reform is needed, it's the reformers' thinking that must be reformed so that it is more in line with true and authentic Islam. Because reformers are basically trying to reform Islam to suit their needs, their taste, and their agenda. What do we call this practice in the West or in the US? Cherry picking, right? So you're selective. According to the Orthodox, reformers are cherry picking. Certain aspects of Islam they are adopting, and the other aspects of it they are thrashing. This is not right. Islam means what? Submission. Submission without questioning. So this is the Orthodox perspective. Now let me share with you the reformist perspective in the time that I have. As I mentioned, the Orthodox traditionalist Muslims accuse the reformers of attempting to rewrite Islam to accommodate modern sensibilities. They typically view reform as an attempt to undermine Islam. In Arabic, they call this bid'ah. Bid'ah. What does bid'ah mean in English?
Innovation.
What?
Innovation.
Yes. To innovate. To bring something new that did not exist before. So that is the contention. Reformists, however, disagree with that. They argue that we are not inventing something brand new. Our project, the Reformation Project, has precedence in Islamic history. What is it called? In Arabic, it's called Ihya. What does Ihya mean in English?
Revival.
Revival, exactly. What does revival, what does revival mean? Anybody, if you look it up in dictionary, what does revival mean?
Give life
to something. Give strength and vigor to something that has lost its vigor. So reformers argue that we are not inventing anything new. We are carrying a tradition that has always existed in Islam, but somehow it is forgotten. It is an example that they would offer you. The example of Abu Hamid Muhammad al-Ghazali, one of the most preeminent Islamic scholars of all time. In the 11th century, al-Ghazali wrote a masterpiece that it's widely read even today. What is the name of his masterpiece? Ihya'i Ulum al-Din, The Revival of Religious Sciences. That was the title of his book. Now, if you read the book very carefully, you will find out that he was complaining about the fact that the authentic and original Islam had been distorted over time. A great deal of alien ideas have infiltrated the Islamic thinking. A lot of superstitions have been added to Islamic theology. Al-Ghazali in the 11th century argued that some of the rituals are blown out of proportion in their importance, while other practices, other values and rituals have been pretty much ignored or disregarded. So he embarked on a so-called theological cleansing project, and the culmination of that was the publication of his masterpiece, Ihya'i Ulumuddin. So, interestingly enough, even though at the time Ghazali was not taken seriously, but later on his works became part of the mainstream Islamic discourse. That's the amazing thing. So, in a word, the tradition of revival, according to reformers, the tradition of revival has continually existed in Islam down to the present day. And the reformers' project is simply a continuation of that tradition. Having said that, let me share with you some of the main features of their perspective. Number one, what is the nature of their proposed reform? What is it that they're proposing that we need to reform? Are they saying that we need to abolish certain Quranic commandments, for example? Is that what they're arguing for reform? Are they saying that we should downplay the importance of maybe some of the controversial verses in the Holy Quran? Is that what they're arguing? They would say absolutely not. That's not what we are talking about. The reformers want to reform Islamic theology. They want to reform Islamic jurisprudence, or what we call fiqh. Fiqh means jurisprudence in English. That's what they want to basically reform. And by the way, theology, jurisprudence, discourse, none of them are divine. They are all human invention. That's the part that the average Muslim does not appreciate and does not understand. You see, as I mentioned, there is a confusion about the nature of theology, religious discourse, and jurisprudence. Their subject matter is divine, right? The subject matter of theology, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about Islam, Christianity, or Judaism, right? The subject matter of theology, religious discourse, and jurisprudence is always divine. But the products that these disciplines produce are entirely human-made. Do you see the distinction between the two? The subject matter is divine. The products are entirely human conceptions. Theology, religious jurisprudence, or fiqh are products of the human mind, not God's words. You see, when a jurist or a theologian reads the Quran, he basically will come away with a reading, with an appreciation that is in line with his intellect. Are you with me so far? It is next to impossible for you to really grasp necessarily the true meaning that God had in mind when he uttered a word. That's what we call phenomenology in philosophy, right? That's what they're arguing. When a theologian, it doesn't matter whether he's a reformer or a traditionalist, it does not matter. When the theologian, the jurist, reads the Quran, he will come away with a reading that is in line with his intellect, educational background, life experiences, social and historical setting in which he lives, And also, more importantly, the prevailing scientific and philosophical mood of his time. Even though he may not be aware of it, we are all products of our time. You see, suddenly a lot of us, Muslims I'm talking about, when we come to the West after a while, we all become in favor of gender equality. But I submit to you, if we had lived in our village back in Iran, in all likelihood we would have exactly the same perspective that our friends back there still hold. It's not that we are smarter than them, it's just that we are, whether we know it or not, we are always under the influence of the philosophical and scientific mood of our time. Basically, the educational background, life experiences, historical setting, they are all filters that then the Quran goes through before it can be comprehended. The same goes holds true for the Bible as well. You see, nobody reads a sacred book with an empty mind. With a blank mind. A blank mind never exists. Do you see what I'm saying? A blank mind, my friend, does not exist. We always read the sacred book through some filters. And these filters are our life experiences, educational background, social class, and the society in which we live. So this is how, in a nutshell, how theology, legal codes, and belief systems are formed. Even though the Quran is sacred and divine, everything that the theologians and jurists derive from the Quran are human perceptions. They are not divine. They can be questioned, they can be refuted, and they can be shelved without questioning the authority of the Quran. See, there is a difference between questioning the authority of the Quran and questioning a given reading of the Quran, a given understanding of the Quran. So this is what the reformers have in mind when they speak of reformation in Islam. They do not question the divine origin of the Quran, its authenticity, or its authority. What they question are some of the readings, some of the appreciations and commentaries that were made in the past by certain scholars, and those readings, according to the reformers, are not meaningful to us in the modern world. So we cannot relate to it. So that's number one. So the first thing is that this is, you know, the nature of the reform that they're arguing. The second point, the primary motto of the reformers is, let's return to the Quran. Let's return to the Quran. That's their motto. Those of you who are Christians or have studied the history of Christianity, who made the same call? Let's return to the Bible. Who made that call? Martin Luther. That was one of the major hallmarks of his thinking. Luther made exactly the same call during Christian Reformation. He said, you know what? Let's go to the source. Let's learn Christianity from the source. Reformers are saying exactly the same thing when it comes to their Reformation. Let's return to the Quran. You see, Islam is a text-centric religion. That's one of the differences between Islam and Christianity, by the way. Christianity, it centers around the life and the person of Jesus Christ, peace be upon him. Judaism revolves around the destiny of a tribe, the Jewish tribe. Islam, however, revolves around a book called the Quran. That is one of the fundamental differences between these three religions. It's the accent, it's the focus. It's very different between the three. So, originally, now here's a very critical point, and I hope that you appreciate it. You see, originally, the Prophet Muhammad's companions and immediate followers understood Islam to be identical with the Quran. Right? At the time of the Prophet Muhammad, when you would ask a Muslim, what is Islam? He would point to you, not what Muhammad was saying himself, but what he was saying that God had revealed to him. Right? For them, for early Muslims, Islam was synonymous with the Quran. The question is it true today? I submit to you that it is not. So that's the core of what these reformers are saying. Let's return to the Quran. Soon after the death of the Prophet Muhammad, things began to change. First, some folks started collecting the sayings of the Prophet Muhammad, and in the Shi'i tradition, the Imams or the Saints. That's basically what is called Sunnah, or the oral tradition in Islam. Next, and here is a very critical development, those sayings of the Prophet and the Saints gradually were elevated to the same level as the Holy Quran. It was a very gradual process. So in time, the oral tradition, the sayings of the Prophet and the saints, basically carried the same weight in issuing religious edicts and religious rulings. Finally, the edicts of muftis and the clergymen were also became part of the Islamic law. And I submit to you, much of what the average Muslim today calls Islamic law are nothing but the edicts of muftis and the clergymen. Much of it is basically nothing but their rulings. As I mentioned before, in reality, very little of Sharia or Islamic law are Quranic commandments. The majority are the opinions of jurists and theologians. Again, unfortunately, the average Muslim on the street does not differentiate and distinguish between God's commandments and the opinions of the jurists. Today, according to the reformers, the body of knowledge known to ordinary Muslims as Islam is filled with superstitions, with hearsays, and even statements that are downright in contradiction to the Holy Quran. That's what I find fascinating. Sometimes even in the QA session, people quote me, you know, statements that they say Islam says such and such, and they are in direct contradiction of the sayings of the Quran. Reformers believe that only the instructions directly from God are binding on Muslims, not the opinion of jurists or theologians. Muslims should return to the Quran as the source of their religiosity. So that's their motto. Let's return to the Quran. The third point that I want to mention with respect to the reformers' perspective. Reformers view the Quran as a living document. The Quran is a living document. Let's think about that for a sec. What does living imply? What does life imply? Life always changes, doesn't it? Life is about change. Life is all about adaptation. So when the reformers say that the Quran is a living document, are they implying that we should change the text of the Quran? Not really. The text of the Quran stays the same for eternity. It never changes. The text remains the same. However, the meaning that the text have will always change from one historical era to another. The text remains the same, but the meaning that the words imply and carry will always change. And by the way, it has always changed. So that's another important point with respect to the reformist thinking. The next one, which is very important. Reformers are against religious formalism. What does formalism mean? Formalism means formalities, right? Things that are at the outer layer of religion. Religious formalism basically means that. So, the traditional religious upbringing that pretty much all Muslims have emphasizes formalities. The depth of one's faith is typically measured by how much and how well the person observes the rules and rituals. How many times you pray every day and how well do you do the mechanics. And I guess I'm not exaggerating. That's the traditional upbringing that most of us have had. So in religious formalism, the emphasis is on, in Arabic we call it ahkam, which means religious commandments and observances. Now the question that reformers ask is this: is religious formalism justified? Especially in the Islamic context, they would say, no, it does not. Let me explain what they mean by that. You see, even though the traditional upbringing of all Muslims emphasize rituals, emphasize ahkam or commandments, less than 10% of the verses of the Quran are about commandments. If you do the math, it's probably closer to 3%. Read the Quran cover to cover and then identify how many verses deal with commandments, do's and don'ts. In my estimation, it's less than 3%. Some people, with all the repetitions, they go as high as 10%. So, commandments about daily prayers, about fasting, pilgrimage, marriage, divorce, penal code, civil code, less than 10% of the Holy Quran. This 10% shape the religion of Muslim masses today. That's what religious formalism is all about. What about the other 90%? They are not even discussed most of the time. People are not even aware of it. I'm not talking about people who go to, you know, Harvard or Yale. I'm talking about the average Muslim on the street in Tehran, in Riyadh, so on and so forth. All they keep hearing are the 10% that deal with do's and don'ts. So typically, when the formalities are emphasized, people miss the point of religiosity. Well, I don't want to be too abstract in my argument. Let me give you a very controversial example. If I ask you, what do you think, especially non-Muslims in the audience, by the way, by what you see on the news or what you hear from Muslims, what do you think would be the symbol of a woman's faith today? What is the symbol of a Muslim woman's faith? What? Lady in the back. The headscarf. Right? Am I exaggerating? That is the symbol of a Muslim woman's faith. Let me ask you this question for those of you who are familiar with the Quran. Does this have any basis in the Quran? Absolutely not. You cannot find a single verse in the Quran that would measure the depth of a female's faith with the headscarf. I'm not saying that this is right or wrong, the headscarf. That's not the point of my presentation. It's the emphasis I'm talking about. The emphasis. The emphasis is misplaced. Muslim reformers have the same objection against the Muslim religious establishment today as Jesus had against the Jewish establishment of his time. Exactly the same objection. Muslim reformers feel that they are in the same boat as Jesus Christ, peace be upon him. Because Jesus also, in his time, the Jewish faith had been reduced to religious rules, religious law, dogma, and basically rigid observances. If you read the New Testament, that's the message you're getting. That the Jewish faith had been reduced to these rigid, you know, observances and dogma. The Jewish faith at that time would not fire the imagination of the religious folk. It would not inspire them to seek God, to reform their thinking, their character, so that they would become more receptive to the message of God. That was the problem that Jesus Christ faced during his time. Reformers feel that they are in exactly the same boat. Reformers, again, I want to emphasize that they respect and they practice the religious law. However, the religious law or fiqh has secondary importance for them. The primary importance is with spirituality and morality. If I were to say it in a philosophical way, the core of religion, any religion, Islam, Judaism, or Christianity, it does not matter. The core of any religion is faith. If somebody who has true faith, we will look at the world in a completely different way. So the core of religion is about spirituality and morality. The shell of religion are these observances. So the shell must be in the service of the core, to protect the core. Unfortunately, these days in the Islamic world, we have a shell with no core, nothing in it. That's what they call, the reformers call, religious formalism, and they object to it. A couple of points and I'm going to close the lecture. Here is another important characteristic of the reformist thinking. Extremely important for, especially for U.S. foreign policy, by the way. Reformers have a, are you with me? They have a minimalist view of religion. See, you can have two different appreciations of any religion. Islam, Christianity, Judaism, doesn't matter. You can have a minimalist appreciation versus a maximalist appreciation. The Orthodox conservative traditional group has a maximalist view of Islam. What does that mean? When they say that Islam is perfect, and perfect means comprehensive, they have a maximalist view of Islam. Islam is here to inform us on every little thing that we need to know. Right? Religion is like the Walmart, one-stop shop. Everything that you possibly need, would ever need, is given to you under the roof of religion. Don't underestimate what I just said. If you go to Iran today, you will hear a lot of bizarre comments. Islamic sociology, Islamic economy, Islamic psychology. Yes, the Iranians probably would understand what I'm talking about. Islamic philosophy. Islam doesn't have a philosophy. Islam doesn't have an economic system. I will get to that in a sec. So, if you have a maximalist perspective of religion, your religion will be just like the Walmart. Under one roof, all of your needs are pretty much satisfied. Reformers also believe that Islam is a perfect religion, albeit for the exact opposite reason. Islam is not comprehensive. Isn't that amazing? How's that for diversity in Islam? You see, the traditionalists argue that Islam is perfect because it is comprehensive. Reformers would say Islam is perfect because it is not comprehensive. Let me explain to you what they mean by that. You see, when it comes to the organization of public life, original Islam had intentionally left out all the details. The original Islam, when it came to organization of life, it had left the details out, because the details must be worked out by each successive Muslim generation into the future. In every historical and social setting, each generation should work out the details. You cannot be consumers of the thinking of the past generation when it comes to social policy and even penal code, by the way. Now, consider the Quran. This is how reformers would argue. They say, consider the Holy Quran, which is the source of Islam. Contrary to the orthodox claim, the Quran does not cover all aspects of human life. The Quran does not address all human needs in any meaningful way. And I want to underscore meaningful. It does not. The Quran does not cover a lot of things that are extremely important to us. It doesn't cover medicine. It doesn't cover scientific disciplines. It doesn't cover technology. These are the obvious ones, obviously. But there is more. If you read the Quran cover to cover, you will not be informed about the rules for a functioning economy. Those of you who have read the Quran, I mean, honest to God, can you read the Quran and tell me, I'm talking about all the rules for a functioning economy. The way that, let's say, Adam Smith talked about the market economy in detail. You don't find it in the Quran. Some people may try to inject it into the Quran by some bizarre interpretations. The fact of the matter is, the rules governing a functioning economy are not mentioned in the Quran. The Quran does not inform you of the type of political system that a Muslim society should have. Should Muslims adopt a monarchy, a parliamentary democracy, a caliphate system, rule of the jurist as they have in Iran today? What is the ideal political system in Islam? The Quran is absolutely silent on that. Or even the complete set of civil and penal code that you need to have a functioning judiciary. You don't have that in the Quran as well. The reformers ask this question. Why? Why don't we find the complete set of details that we need in the Quran? The answer is very simple. Religion, be it Christianity, Judaism, or Islam, religion is general, is not meant, has never been meant to be a substitute for philosophy, for sociology, for economics, so on and so forth. It was never meant to be like that. Religion does not compete with these scientific and philosophical disciplines. God's prophets did not come to put philosophers and scientists out of business. Now, reformers have a warning to their Muslim compatriots. Do not repeat the same mistakes that Christians did in the Middle Ages. During the Middle Ages, a maximalist view of Christianity prevailed. The Christian church expected that all the rules for a functioning society be derived from the church's teaching. They had a maximalist view of religion. It failed. For 1,000 years, for a whole 1,000 years, Europe was in deep darkness. That's what they call it, the Dark Ages. Right? Europe was backward scientifically, technologically, socially, philosophically, in every respect, Europe was in dark ages because a maximalist view of Christianity and religion prevailed. So reformers basically have this advice for their Muslim counterparts. The last point I want to make, and I'm going to close the lectures, and this is also very important and extremely controversial, and I left the controversial point for the last. Reformers are often at odds with the Muslim religious establishment or the clergy. They are very much at odds with the clergy. That is why most reformers are not tolerated in their homeland. Most of them ultimately have to immigrate to the West, including Hamid Entezam. We cannot speak our mind. We are persecuted. That's what happens. Typically, the religious establishment, it's always been the case, by the way, throughout history, that the religious establishment, if they hold the levers of political power, they will never tolerate theological dissent. And that's one of the reasons why reformers are at odds with the religious and clerical establishment. You see, in any religion, there is an assumption behind the clerical establishment, especially when they hold the levers of power, that the clerical establishment speaks for that religion. They are the authority on that religion. They are the ones who will tell the average person on the street what God meant by saying such and such words in the Holy Book. Reformers argue that Islam does not have any official caretaker or custodian. But the fact of the matter is, in every Muslim society, you will find a group of people who have appointed themselves as the guardians of Islam, as the caretakers of Islam. They are the ones who decide who a Muslim is and who is not a Muslim. They are the ones who decide what Islam is and what is not. Usually, what the so-called fatwas or religious rulings that you hear in the media are issued by the clerical establishment, who claim that they are the official spokespeople of Islam. Yet, the reformers argue, the Quran has absolutely no instruction for creating an official body or institution to care for Islam. Again, I challenge you on that. If you read the Quran cover to cover, you will not find a single verse that would instruct Muslims that there needs to be an institution, an official body who will speak on behalf of God. It doesn't exist in the Quran. So the reformers argue, where does this whole idea of having an official custodian of religion come from? Reformers argue, not definitely from the Holy Quran. What's more, even if you go by the tradition of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, there are no instructions in his sayings for creating an official body to care for Islam or to speak on behalf of Islam. So, according to the reformers, there is no official caretaker or spokesperson for Islam. So what is the significance of that? What is the significance of this reformist point? Well, the significance is this. Reformers defend the right of every Muslim to make her own mind what Islam is and what God says. Reformers argue for freedom of interpretation of the Holy Quran. People not only should be free to think whatever they want about Islam, they should also have the freedom to express their mind and their opinion. The Quran is a book from God intended for nas, for the people. Right? The word of God for the average person on the street. Freedom of conscience, freedom of interpretation, and freedom of expression of what you have come up with. That's what the reformers are fighting for in the Islamic world, without fear of persecution and punishment by the religious establishment. Well, I guess I have spoken enough, and I hope I haven't bored you to death. Let me summarize with a few key points, and I'm going to close my lecture. As I mentioned, there is an emerging new division in Islam between reformers and traditionalists. This new division, in my opinion, is a direct consequence of modernity. The Orthodox traditional Muslims are conservative in every respect, They have a very dim view of modernity. Reformers, on the other hand, they don't have such a negative view of modernity. They actually want Islam to survive the tides of modernity. So they argue for adaptations. Islamic theology, Islamic jurisprudence must adapt to the new circumstances. They still argue that Muslims should remain steadfast about the core values of Islam. Muslims should really hang on to the Quran as their holy book. However, they must be open to new interpretations of that sacred book. We should not restrict the interpretation of the Quran to what the older generations have provided for us. That's the core of their thinking. I apologize if I spoke over time, and thank you very much for your patience and attention, and God bless you all. Thank you.